And you can put it aside for a while, because by the time we die, we're generally pretty sick of this planet. Not always, that's not at all true. You know, if your life is snatched away prematurely, if you die young, if you die in war, if you're murdered or something, you can be extremely anxious to get back. If you die in comfortable old age after having experienced a lot, sometimes you're just pretty pooped out and you just don't want anything to do with it for a while. But slowly you get your energy back. You know, maybe if you've traveled a lot and you come home, you're really content to be home for 2, 3, 4, 5 weeks until it starts coming in again. Right? That's just the astral world. So you have to be very vigilant all the time. I mean, you have to understand, you have to live properly, but you have to be conscious of what you're doing with your consciousness. Because you have to deal with it. You don't get away with it. You think you get away with it. One of my friends, about herself, she said, when her child was small, she more or less just waited for the child to grow up. You know, just never really like took it on. And then the child sort of reached a middle period where it was fine, and then the child got into early teens, and sometimes there's a great resemblance, they say, between early teens and toddlerhood, and sometimes, and like the birds, whatever it is that comes back to roost. What comes back to roost? Chickens. I was going to say crows. The chickens came back to roost. And she was honest enough to say, I thought I was going to get away with it. You know? Because suddenly the teenage child required every bit as much energy and attention as the toddler had required, and she had not given the toddler. She said, I thought I was going to get away with it. You know? But you don't, ever. So, now or later, doesn't make any difference. All right, is that sufficient? Duncan, you had a question in the midst of that? Okay, good. Any other questions on this? That was a good question, Sandy, thank you. Yes, Doris.
But there are a lot of beings that are forced to reincarnate.
The question is, beings are forced to incarnate, but they're not forced by anybody up there, they're forced by their own desires, which is that in order to progress at all, they have to be somewhere where they at least know that they're alive. And that's what I think it's in this book, isn't it, where Master says that if you're not, I mean, just think about this world. Many people live on many different gross levels. Every so often, I hope I'm not speaking to anybody in this room, but I drive down the highway and I see those cars that people made where they made them really, really high with huge tires, and you know, you practically did have to have a stepladder, and you just see them all shined up in every detail, and I just can't help but think, why? You know, like, why would anyone spend their time and money? If any of you have spent your time and money, please tell me why. You know? Or you see individuals, and they're just, they're so identified with their vehicles that you can just really see that I am my car. It's not a very, I don't mean to generalize, but that's not a very refined level. And sometimes people just can't experience anything subtle. They just can't. If the music is too subtle, if the colors are too subtle. When we first moved into our apartment complex, the decorating style of the people who lived there was extremely impressive. The place was an absolute dump to begin with, a total dump. I mean, it was a teardown. It still is, but at least it's an attractive teardown. But it was just a dump. And it was so hideous, and they had all these brown shag rugs, which was bad enough, and no light. But the people who lived in it kept the curtains closed and brought in brown furniture. You know, like that was their astral picture. See, because this world is projected from the astral. So whichever astral world you have been in, that's more real than this one. That's a very hard thing to understand. The astral world is more real than this world. I said this on Sunday. Swamiji was saying this to Linda Gerber, who was about to go into the astral world. He said, this world is very thick and very vague. The astral world is crystal clear. Isn't that interesting, really, to think about? He said, here, it's very dreamlike. He said, you can't remember, as he put it, what you were thinking 5 minutes ago. It just fades away. But in the astral world, everything is very vivid and you're very much more awake. The body just dulls us down so much. So this world, as it says in the book, this world is projected from the astral world. And bear in mind, when we go to the astral world, we go to our own astral world. We go to the thing about the astral world, which is very relaxing, especially for people like us, is that it's homogeneous in its vibrations. You go to the sphere that matches your vibrations. Here, we are in such chaos that you have to walk down the street and be subjected to things that are totally dissonant to our vibrations. And so much is happening on this planet that's so dissonant to our vibrations. The good news is in the astral world, because it just is vibrations, you're just with your own vibrations. And very refined people are in beautiful astral spheres. And then when our desires or our karma brings us down to this planet, because that's our reality, we try to recreate it. Thus, this is our astral world. Look at it. We did our best to try to make this our astral world. And just sort of the inclination to create beauty. Linda Gerber herself, most of you may not even know her anymore, but she used to do flowers and her own home. And you could just see she was always trying to create some sphere that was golden light. That was just her concept of the way things ought to look is golden light. And, it's very frustrating on the material plane, but she was extremely imaginative and did a very good job of trying to recreate it. Well, the people who lived in these apartments, who, with all due respect, were not people who had, for the most part, had inspiring consciousness, the apartments were hideously ugly, with no light. They kept the curtains closed and brought brown furniture into it. One man even parked his motorcycle in the living room because that was their astral universe. when they went to the astral world, it was kind of brown, just like Master says in here, gray, brown. That's just kind of like the foundation stone that they come here and they play it out again. That's why there's no accounting for taste. Because we were all from different spheres. Now, how did I get started on that? What brought that? Oh, you talk about people being forced to incarnate. So if you're there, and the only thing you know how to experience is on a very tangible, material level, nothing is happening. You got to get back in the game. So you rest sufficiently, because sometimes we're just really tired out. We just do not have the will to go on. It's just been too hard, too much pain, too much suffering. Maybe we were really sick at the end. Maybe we got really disappointed. We need a break. And so we go up to the astral world and we sleep for a really long time. Think about it again. See, these are all very commonsensical, because this world is a reflection of higher realities. So just think, if you just had a really tough experience, and you would just want to go home and you would sleep. And maybe you would sleep, or you would just sleep through a few years of your life. You didn't want to risk anything. You didn't want to put out any energy. You didn't want to get involved with anybody. You just wanted a break. And then slowly by slowly, as one of my friends said once, it's just not that easy to lie down and die. You try it, and then after a while, you get up. So you try to lie down and die in the astral world and just check out, and then you recover a little bit, and you start thinking about cigarettes or Starbucks or beer or murdering people or whatever it is, that really gives you a little bit of energy, and bingo, you're here again doing it. We have a lot of demons coming in right now who have lots of really vile intentions. So it's, you do come down to hurt other people too. It just depends on who you are. You can't do that in the astral world in the same way. Brenda? Mm-hmm. I can't remember the response either. Remember the question. Oh, he's blinded so that the glory of God could be demonstrated. He didn't answer the question. He ducked it. Yeah. Pardon me? The question is, it has to do with whether karma is really punishment. And we're talking about people who are born with deformities, infirmities of one kind or another. So what is going on is really the issue. Okay, now you have to think of it like this. Let's say we have done a lot of things in our lives that have gradually caused us to get confused about the divine law. What was that chapter at the beginning? The law of life. The law of life is bliss. But maybe we're doing all kinds of things that are really getting us mixed up about what the law of life really is. And so we need to learn what the law of life is, and we generally learn from our own experience. We don't generally learn because somebody sits you down and says, now, understand, the soul identified with the body, so don't do that anymore. It's just like we don't get it. Or, taking those people's money like that really is not a good idea. But the person will answer you back and say, why? I had a legitimate contract. I had a fair deal. you know, that's the way the cookie crumbles. That's what people will say. They don't get it. The businessman who's taking care of his family doesn't understand that he's hurting somebody else's family. Well, that's not my problem, that's his problem. So you're getting away from the law of life. So there is an impersonal reality here, which is when you break the divine law, which is try to get your happiness by a method that does not produce happiness, then there has to be a correction. But that correction is not offered in order to drive you down. That correction is offered in order to lift you up, so that you can say, so you're on the side of the person who gets cheated out of all their money time and time again by some shyster who thinks he's doing the right thing, and you say, this is a horrible experience to be treated like that. Now you can have one of two reactions. The one is, I want enough power to get mine against him, which is what we do, we play ping pong for a long time. But eventually, it's just like, this feels so terrible. I don't want anybody to ever feel like this again. And so that which looked like punishment actually has eventually lifted you to a higher state of consciousness, if you take it correctly. So have you been punished by being forced to learn a lesson that might have been hard and that required suffering in order to learn it? But once you learn it, it's the end of all suffering for you? Is that a punishment? No, I mean, that's how you have to think about it. So is it a reward to have everything go well and never get the consequences of your own actions? Think about when you're raising children. Parents who, in the name of kindness, never appropriately discipline their children raise adults who don't have a clue. Did the parents really help them by not punishing them when they did something wrong? So sometimes you're born with disabilities or infirmities or extreme obstacles and so on because you need it. It's exactly what you need to take your own, and not sometimes, always. It's exactly what you need to take your own next step. Will you take that step, or will you either keep playing ping pong or go down even further? Well, that's your choice. It's really up to us that we decide. But to think merely, see, this is why people talk about good and bad karma, but there's no such thing as bad karma. Because what is bad karma? Bad karma is, to us, that it makes us work or it makes us suffer. But to make us work or to make us suffer, is that bad? You know, where does the word bad come from? I'd rather be allowed to get away with it and never have to face the consequences of my own actions. That's a punishment. So the difficulty is in the way we define good and bad, rather than the thought that these things happen. And that's, you know, that's where you become more detached. You become more impersonal. You become less concerned about me in this. You just say, this isn't necessary. And you also see, and you don't think cruelly, because you see somebody who's born deaf or born in some other way disabled. If you give them help, then it will help them use what has happened to them to rise. And so you play your part instead of just saying, oh, it's just their karma. Well, yes, it is their karma, but whether that karma helps them or just oppresses them even more depends on how they relate to it, and maybe I can help them relate to it. And then everything begins to move forward. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
There's a wonderful story. It's written by a Frenchman about a young boy who went blind suddenly at the age of 8. And it's a chapter from a book. I wish I could remember the name of the book. But anyway, he suddenly lost his sight at the age of 8 years old. And he had very enlightened parents, and he was obviously a person of great spiritual understanding himself. Because of the way his parents treated him, and because of his own understanding, he very quickly discovered that he could still see. But he didn't see with physical eyes, and he didn't see the physical world. But essentially, really what he's saying is he could see the astral energy of things. And he could even describe the trees. He knew where the doorways were. He knew what rooms looked like. But what he saw was colors and light and energy. And so he learned to function completely because he could still see. And he talked about the fact that he was very fortunate, because when he told his parents that he could see, they believed him. But he also found it was very interesting, he said, that if he became emotionally upset, he couldn't see anymore. Because that perception required a subtle kind of attunement. Isn't that interesting? He would lose his capacity to see when he became angry or afraid. And actually, he lived in France during the war, and he became an invaluable person in the resistance because he could tell whether people were lying or not. And he could tell who was a genuine friend and who was a spy for the other side. And so he was able, because other people would look and couldn't tell, but he could look into their nature. He could see the colors of their aura. Isn't that interesting? It was a fascinating story. And he talked about when he was 15, he met another boy who was blind. And he talked about it was the most sad person he'd ever met because that boy believed he couldn't see. And he said his parents had persuaded him that he couldn't see. And he'd also lost his sight at a young age in the same way. Very interesting. Now, what am I saying about that? Oh, it's about whether it's punishment or not. That's why Yogananda says in this book, all conditions are neutral. Where we go with it, whether we go up or down with it, entirely depends on how we relate to it. Now, that's a fundamental rule of the karmic law. There's no such thing as bad karma. There's just karma. Karma is unlearned lessons, which brings you the circumstances you need to learn them. Marilyn?
The concept that you can...
She says, we learn from having our desires frustrated, but we learn more from having them fulfilled. That's a very interesting statement. Now, the point of that is this. Sooner or later, you're going to have to experience it because you're not going to believe that it won't make you happy if you think it's going to make you happy. So that's the premise of that. Now, what that means is, for example, if a person who's blind is really persuaded that they won't be happy until they can see, sooner or later they're going to have an incarnation in which they can see, and they're going to have to experience what it's like to have really good vision, and then they're going to have to realize that they still need to find God. Because that's how it works. And that's also an incentive for saying you can't hide from your desires, you have to relate to them, because you can't just throw them away. Is that related to that? Yeah. And that's why also you can't tell people things. You can't say to people who are poor, oh, money won't make you happy. They always answer, well, give me some and I'll try it out for myself, which is a fair answer. And that's why you can't try to impose what you have realized on people who aren't ready to realize it, because they just don't know. You have to find other ways to do it. That's why Yogananda very seldom said anything direct to people. Even though he knew every thought people were thinking. He never tried to correct you that way, Swamiji says. He just put you into situations that would allow you to have the experiences you needed, that would give you the lessons you need so you would know it yourself. And the way Swami writes it is, as much as possible, Master allowed us to live out our fantasies. You call that the sort of almost hang yourself school of karmic learning. You know, just pushing you right to the edge of tragedy. That's why, as much as possible. You know, if you think that's what you need to do, then go do it. You'll find out. But he didn't say it like that. And that's why, even with Swami Kriyananda, it's really very tricky to know whether he really approves. You can't just say, well, is it okay if I do this? Swami said yes, you know, because if you're determined to do it, he's not going to say no. Especially if you're already committed. If you're already committed, he's not going to say no. Where's the growth in that? So it's very subtle, because he'll say yes to you when he could give you better advice. But if you're not receptive to that advice, he won't give it to you. That's what I really mean. Is that really that he wants you to do something else? There might be a better question to ask than, should I do this when I'm already ready to do it? Right. You have to ask the right question to get the right answer. If you ask a question to which you already know the answer, or you have such strong desires, as much as possible, they'll just let you live it out. That's why you can end up with 15 people saying all emphatically and definitely, this is what Swami wants. That's why it's not really a very good thing to say. Sometimes we all get together and we say, well, what did he say to you when you asked him? And you can kind of piece together from the whole picture what understanding he really had in his mind. But he was just relating it to everybody's realities.